This is the story of two skulls. It's actually the mystery of two skulls. And a long, incredible investigation to find the identity of those two people, or those two skulls. It's detective work. It's archaeology. But you know what? It really is like science fiction. And that's for us. That's for me and you and all the people listening. The techniques that are discussed here on identifying the mystery of these two skulls a few years ago was not even invented. Now it's like something, it's the beginning of a walk down the Jurassic Park trail. But when those two people died, the two skulls that we're trying to find who the identity was, the techniques that we're going to be discussing today would have seemed like voodoo. They would have seemed like medieval spirituality and magic rolled in. It would have been extraordinary. So buckle your seatbelts. This is a story that features one of France's most famous explorers, pirates, shipwrecks, kidnappings, ambushes, and of course, murder. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you're in the world. Welcome to Crime Waves. My name is Declan Hill. I was an investigative journalist specializing in organized crime and corruption, and now I'm a professor of investigations at the University of New Haven. And on this show, myself and my students examine murder, corruption, organized crime, criminology, forensic sciences, and essentially all things detective. And the theme this week is forensic archaeology, or the introduction of modern-day technologies of DNA with ancient, or at least in this case, historical cases going back hundreds of years. And our guide this week for the topic is Crime Waves regular Professor Angie Ambers. Professor Ambers, if you haven't listened to her before, is brilliant. She is an eclectic genius that every time I have lunch with her, I'm talking to her, it's just like, man, what did I do wrong in grade school? You know, how couldn't I have become a forensic geneticist at the University of North Texas and then at the University of New Haven? But that's just part of what she does. She's also worked at the Center for Human Identification. That is where police or somebody discovers a heap of bones somewhere in the desert and they bring it to a laboratory. And Angie Ambers is the person they turn to. That's her specialization, the characterization, the identification of contemporary, historical, and archaeological and human skeletal remains. Angie, welcome to Crime Waves again.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you again. Let's just kick off because this is an extraordinary story. Tell the listeners, please, what happened in 1684?
Okay, sure. So the French explorer La Salle, he had explored the New World many, many times prior to this expedition that we're going to talk about. On his last expedition, King Louis of France had gifted him five sailing ships to come back to the New World. And the goal of this particular expedition was to discover where the Mississippi River dumps into the Gulf of Mexico. So essentially to discover the mouth of the Mississippi River. And then an additional goal was to set up and establish a French colony on the banks of the Gulf of Mexico. And so they embarked, La Salle and his team and the five ships, they embarked on a journey from France and arrived at the coast of Texas in 1684. And one of the ships during the journey was captured by pirates, so they lost that ship. Another one of them was essentially serving as a military escort ship. So as soon as they reached the coast of Texas, that ship returned to France. And the La Belle was the actual ship that La Salle was sailing on, and there were about 30 individuals on that ship, including La Salle's expedition scribe, Henri Joutel, who was his purpose essentially was to keep a diary account of the entire expedition.
And he did an amazing job. I spent, you know, in our recent preparation, our research for this, I spent a long time reading his journal and diary. And basically De La Salle's expedition, I say De La Salle because that's the way we say it up in French part of Canada. It was like, you know, Murphy's Law hits exploration. Everything that could have gone wrong went wrong with this expedition.
Yes. So when they reached the coast of Texas, they thought they had found the exact location where the Mississippi River dumps into the Gulf of Mexico. And so to kind of escape the potential for encountering additional pirates, as well as the weather of the open sea, La Salle decided to sail into the Matagorda Bay for protection from that. And then they took, they anchored in Matagorda Bay, and they took smaller boats to shore, to the shoreline, because they realized they weren't in the exact location. So they wanted to kind of scout on the land to decide ultimately where they needed to sail to. And
fair, they're at least 300-400 miles lost at that point. But De La Salle, when he came to Canada, lived in a village called Lachine, L-A-C-H-I-N-E. And as all the French speakers who listen to this program will tell you, that actually means China in French. And that's how lost everyone was in North America. They thought that if they kept walking west, they were eventually going to get to China. China was just going to be that next valley. It was just going to be over that next body of water. Even, you know, 100 and umpteen years since Columbus, they still thought this is how bad that sense of geography was at that time.
Yes. Yeah, so La Salle obviously realized he wasn't in the exact location. He realized his navigation was off. So while they were scouting, while he and a few of his men were scouting along the shoreline, a big storm came and sank the La Belle in the Matagorda Bay, along with all of the provisions that King Louis had provided them with to establish their French colony. So,
and the provisions, you know, that just, you know, that the jokes can start there. You know, the Camembert cheese, the baguettes, the French bread. You know, you were sure those provisions must have been something typically French.
And the
good
wine,
food,
I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah, and you know, and it was also article, you know, items like jewelry and bowls and drinking glasses and things like this that they could use at the French colony that they were planning to establish, as well as things that they could trade with the local Native Americans to make friends, you know, so to speak. And the Matagorda Bay was relatively shallow, and the masts on these ships were pretty tall. And so after the ship sank, the Spanish arrived sometime later, and they were able to see the very tip of the mast sticking out of the water. And that is actually how the Texas Historical Commission archaeological team first started searching or getting an idea for that the La Belle shipwreck was in the
now,
bay.
Now, before we get to the discovery of the ship, almost 400 years later, actually over 400 years later, let's talk about the nightmare of the final part of De La Salle's expedition, because his ship gets sunk, the supplies get wrecked, then he gets murdered by his men, and then the Indians attack.
Yes. So obviously, when the supplies and provisions that were on the La Belle and on one of the other ships, because the other ship sank upon entrance to Matagorda Bay. It was a very narrow passageway, and that ship sank, and then later the La Belle sank. And so they obviously were not very well equipped to live off the land and establish a colony without the supplies that they had brought over from France. So within a year, they did set up a makeshift French colony, and of course they named it Fort St. Louis after the king. And within a year of setting up that colony, they were really struggling. People were dying. Over half of the people in the colony had passed away. And La Salle and several of his able-bodied men decided to leave on foot and try to go find help for the remaining colonists at Fort St. Louis. And during that trek, LaSalle's men mutinied on him and actually murdered him. And his body has never been located. So we don't know where De La Salle actually ended up. But while they were gone trying to find help, the local Karankawa Indians massacred everybody at Fort St. Louis.
It's just extraordinary. I mean, it's like some kind of 1684, 1686 horror movie. You know, everything that can go wrong goes wrong for this poor expedition. Now, again, in the research, I was looking at the mystery of what happened to La Belle, because to the French, this was like a pretty big thing. You know, in those terms, equipping five ships to sail to unknown lands, to maybe find China, to whatever, was, it was kind of the equivalent of our space travel now. You know, there's an enormous amount of money, enormous amount of resource. To us, you know, it's a bunch of wooden ships. It doesn't seem very much. But to those guys in that times of resource, it was a big expedition. And so the disappearance of La Belle, you know, there's a number of famous paintings, you know, of La Belle, you know, going into a storm, or La Belle in a sunset or something. You know, it really was the kind of Marie Celeste murder mystery, disappearance mystery. How did they discover its final location?
So the Texas Historical Commission has an archaeological team that, for whatever reason, I don't know the background on this, they were very interested in Spanish and French archaeology, and they had actually read in the diary accounts, not just of Henri Joutel, who was La Salle's expedition scribe, but also diary accounts of the Spanish explorers who arrived after La Salle's ship sank. They had done their historical archives research, and they realized, based on what the Spanish had said in their documentation, that La Salle's ship was indeed sunk and buried in Matagorda Bay. And when the Spanish arrived after La Salle's ship sank, they saw the mast of the ship sticking out of the water. And they documented this, and they drew some makeshift maps, of course, in their diary. So hand-drawn maps. And that's which obviously were off, you know, they weren't highly accurate. And that's what the Texas Historical Commission archaeological team were using to try to find the exact location. And they were going out, they searched for over 20 years. This was an entire career for the archaeological team trying to locate this shipwreck. And they were using GPS, they were dragging magnetometers behind the boats, you know, hoping that they would get a hit on some of the bronze cannons that typically these European ships were equipped with. And they located it in 1995, and it kind of was this, it was a huge discovery in Texas, not just for the state of Texas, but also for the archaeological team. You know, most archaeologists, from what I hear, never make such a huge discovery in their career. They hope for something like this.
It's extraordinary, you know, to discover something like that sunk quickly. It must have been like discovering a time capsule, you know, straight back to 1684, what they were wearing, what conditions. How, when the shipwreck was discovered, was there a lot of stuff that was in good condition?
Yes. So the way that they initially realized that they had indeed found one of the ships from La Salle's expedition is they pulled up one of the cannons from the ship that was actually embossed or engraved with King Louis's insignia. And so they knew they had hit the jackpot at that point. And then what they did, it was quite fascinating. I had never heard of anything like this before. They built what's called a cofferdam around the shipwreck in the middle of the bay. It's basically a giant metal wall that they built around the shipwreck. And then they pumped all the water out of the cofferdam and essentially did a dry excavation of the shipwreck in the middle of the bay. And they built a platform around the outside of the cofferdam so that as they were excavating all of the contents of the ship, as well as pieces of the ship, they were able to pull them up onto the platform to catalog them and tag them and let them dry, et cetera. But they were having to take boats from the shoreline out to the platform on the cofferdam. So it was to me, not being an archaeologist myself, I'm a forensic geneticist, that was such a fascinating, way to excavate the artifacts and the ship itself. I had never heard of doing a dry excavation of a shipwreck in the middle of the ocean.
It's extraordinary. Now, how do you come to be involved in this archaeological work?
After they excavated the contents of the ship, they actually discovered two sets of human skeletal remains on the ship. And we knew from the ship logs and the diary accounts that there were 30 or so people on that ship. So they weren't sure which two individuals out of the 30 people they had. And so they attempted, and I was not involved in this, but they attempted to have DNA testing in the mid-1990s, and they weren't able to successfully obtain any results. But they cataloged those bones, the Texas Historical Commission did, and they kind of followed the evolution and advancement of forensic DNA testing. And as the testing capabilities evolved and became much better, then the lead archaeologist for the Texas Historical Commission, Dr. James Bruseth, is friends with an anthropologist that I worked with at the Center for Human Identification. And this anthropologist was one of my mentors who I still collaborate with and consider him a great friend now. He's the one that, when the anthropologist that was my mentor and the lead archaeologist for the Texas Historical Commission, we're talking about trying DNA testing again on these skeletal remains, the anthropologist recommended me because I'd already been doing that kind of work. So that's kind of how I got brought into the fray.
You're in the lab, and these two skeletal remains from 1684 come onto your desk. And your job is to figure out who they actually were. I mean, and they've got no clothes on. They've got nothing. They're just skeletal remains, literally. But your job is to track down the name of these people. How do you even start to go about doing something like that?
Okay. So first of all, the story of how I got the remains is quite interesting. So normally when I work cases like this, they ship the remains to me. And in this case, obviously this archaeological team, this was such a grand discovery for them. They did not trust UPS or FedEx or whatever. They basically said, we want you to do this work, but you're going to have to drive down here from Dallas. I lived in Dallas, Texas at the time, and they were in Austin, Texas. So it's about a 4-hour drive. They said, you're going to have to come up here and take possession of the remains and drive back to Dallas. So I did that. I drove down to Austin and got to meet the archaeological team. And it was a great trip. I had planned on just picking up the bones and driving back to Dallas, but they were in the middle of putting together an exhibition at the Bullock Museum in Austin, Texas. The main exhibit was going to be the LaBelle shipwreck and all of the contents that had been excavated. So I got to do a behind-the-scenes tour of the museum exhibit before they opened it to the public. They actually rebuilt the ship, the LaBelle, inside the museum, and they have all of the artifacts. There were over 1 million artifacts that were pulled out of that shipwreck, and they're all on display at the museum. So I got to see that exhibit, and then we packed the remains in my car, and I drove back to Dallas.
I just want to take one little aside here. How does it feel to be driving along a Texas highway with dead people in your car? What is the respect you have to do? Do you have a ceremony or something as you're holding these dead people in a specimen container? What do you do in those cases?
I mean, actually, I have a lot of respect for, you know, these historical figures that I work on. I'm fascinated. I remember the whole 4-hour drive back to Dallas. I was thinking about what they must have gone through sailing over from France. You know, and this was a time period where it's not like they were on a cruise ship with air conditioning and a buffet that they could go and eat at. You know, they were on a wooden ship with no heater, air conditioning, and sailing for months across the ocean. And I just had an enormous amount of respect for what they must have been through to make it to the New World. And then I was thinking, gosh, you know, I hope I don't get pulled over for speeding or have an accident, because the police would probably think I was a serial killer or something with skeletal remains in my car.
I'm not sure how you could have talked your way out of that. So you bring the skeletal remains of these two people. We don't know their names yet, but that's your job. To find out who they are or who they were. Do you have a list of the people who they could have been?
So I myself did not have the list, but the Texas Historical Commission archaeological team was collaborating with a French historian who had the actual ship log with the names of all 30 individuals. And so my job at that point was, number one, just to see, is the DNA still intact enough for us to get a profile? And if and when I'm able to obtain a DNA profile, then we can tackle the job of doing the genealogical research and perhaps hunting down living descendants of all 30 people that were on that ship log to provide us with a cheek swab sample for comparison, so that we hopefully could narrow down which two people we had on the ship.
Wow. So people were going to, part of your international team is over in France, and they're going to find Jean Dupont's great, 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 great grandson or grandnephew or something to be able to track it back and say, this is that person.
Correct.
Could you find the DNA?
So, yes. Yeah, so, I probably should say this too. So on my way back from Dallas, the archaeological team had written a couple of books on the entire expedition. And when I drove back to Dallas, it was a long day and I didn't start working on the remains right away. So I decided to open up these books and read the story behind the expedition and the shipwreck. And I thought I would just kind of peruse or browse through the books. And I ended up staying up all night reading the books, being fascinated by this expedition. And so by the time I got in the lab to do the DNA testing, I knew so much about these individuals that were laying in front of me on a laboratory bench. And there are particular types of bones that are preferable for DNA recovery. And so I started looking at what I had to work with and making a selection of which bones might work best for DNA testing. And ultimately, yes, I was able to get DNA profiles from both individuals. And I used a newer technology. It's kind of up and coming. It's called massively parallel sequencing. And it basically allows us to profile over 300 different DNA markers. And some of these DNA markers will allow us to predict the biogeographic ancestry, the ethnicity or race of the individual.
So if you were to get my DNA, you'd be able to say, right, he originally comes from
Europe
or wherever, I think.
Yes.
And which
of course,
bones
make
the best for testing? Is it your legs, your arm, your skull? What are the best ones?
So if we have a complete skeleton, typically molar teeth, if they're available, or weight-bearing long bones like the femur. These bones are very compact. They're very dense. They're some of the densest and most compact bones in the body. And so they do very well. They provide a lot of protection for the DNA contained within the bones. And with the teeth, of course, teeth are covered by enamel, which is the hardest substance in the human body. So the DNA that's inside of the tooth, assuming the tooth is not cracked or broken, that molecular signature, that DNA of that person, that blueprint for that person, is generally preserved pretty well within that tooth.
Now, however, we're talking about human remains that have been underwater, a lot of time under mud, in the shipwreck for well over 400 years. How much material do you need to make an efficient test? 3 inches, 6 inches, 2 inches? Like, how much do you need?
So it's not really a size. It's basically we take a small cutting from, say, the femur, the weight-bearing long bone of the leg, and we take a small cutting, we clean the cutting so that we make sure we get rid of all of the exogenous or external contaminant DNA, say, from the archaeological team that handled the remains. So we wash the cutting, and then what we have to do to get the DNA out of that bone cutting is we have to submerge it in liquid nitrogen and pulverize it into a fine powder. It's almost like baby powder consistency. And then, of course, from there we mix that bone powder with a series of chemicals that allows us to extract the DNA.
And how new is this technology? I mean, you were saying that in 1995 they didn't have this technology. Is it 10 years old? 5 years old?
So massively parallel sequencing, this technology and capability, we've only been using for maybe 4 or 5 years. Our lab that I worked at in Texas, the Center for Human ID, we did a lot of the beta testing for this technology. It's now being implemented into actual contemporary forensic DNA casework. But it's kind of overkill somewhat for more contemporary type samples, but it's fabulous. It gives us a lot of information when we're working with older historical or archaeological remains.
It really is, as I was reading your case notes, it really seems like the first couple of steps down the Jurassic Park trail, where you can get DNA, you can figure out really specific things from a very, very, very small amount of human remains from hundreds of years ago. Let's go to what you found. What did you find?
Okay, so there was actually something really shocking and interesting that happened during the processing. So I had the bones in my lab in Texas. And of course, at that point, I was waiting until I got results to contact the archaeological team and the anthropologist so we could confer on what we had to work with. And I naturally assumed that we had two Anglo-European French guys on this ship. You know, we knew that they sailed over here from France. And so part of the testing, as I mentioned previously, allows us to look at DNA markers that will predict someone's race or ethnicity. And I was shocked. After the initial round of testing, one of the individuals indeed was Anglo-European ancestry. And the other one, as I was analyzing the data, was showing up as Native American. And I'll be honest with you, at that point, I thought, oh, there's no way. I have to be doing something wrong with my analysis. So I went back. I was like, I'm not going to call this archaeological team and say, you've got one European guy and one Native American on a ship, on LaSalle's ship that sailed over here from France. They're going to think I'm crazy. So before I contacted them, I did a series of multiple additional tests, like months more of tests, and where I was looking at other types of markers that would further confirm or refute that Native American ancestry assessment. And every additional test that I did, it kept coming back Native American. And so, of course, I was thinking, how the heck did why is there a Native American on this ship? So I called the archaeological team. We had a big conference call. And I was really nervous at that point because I thought, you know, they're going to think I don't know what I'm doing. And I had backed up this data analysis over and over again with multiple additional tests. And I told them essentially, okay, you've got one European, one set of remains is European and one set is Native American. And I was expecting them to debate that with me. And
say,
they didn't.
Angie, why did we hire you? We could have got somebody much closer. You've driven all this way. Putting all silly jokes aside, could it have been that De La Salle's people had kidnapped a native, you know, as some of these French, Spanish explorers were wont to do? The natives would come out to trade with them. They'd say, hey, come on board the boat, and grab them to take them back to France or Spain to show off. Could it have been that?
So I was surprised when I told them that one of the individuals was Native American. They weren't surprised. They actually told me that there was a Native American on the ship log that had ironically sailed over from France with LaSalle. LaSalle had befriended a Native American named Nika on one of his prior expeditions, and Nika had become part of his expedition crew. Because he spoke the local Native American language and he could be a guide for LaSalle and help, you know, help the European team make peace with the natives as they were establishing their colonies. So we knew, though, at that point, after discussions with the archaeological team, that Nika, it was not Nika. Nika was not the Native American that we had discovered in the shipwreck.
Nika had got off the ship somehow. We knew that.
Yeah, so there were diary accounts of the people that survived the shipwreck and the massacre at Fort St. Louis that had made it back to France. And there was diary accounts that Nika was murdered after the massacre at Fort St. Louis on a trip back to Canada to sail back to France. So there's basically two theories about who this Native American that was recovered from the LaBelle shipwreck might be. One is that, yes, exactly what you were proposing is that LaSalle and the team did befriend some natives on the shoreline when they were searching for which direction to go to find the Gulf of Mexico, and that this person happened to be brought back to the ship, I don't know, perhaps to drink some wine or whatever, to trade for some of the artifacts that were part of the provisions and supplies on the ship, and maybe was on the ship when the storm came and sank the ship. The other theory, which is plausible, remember I said that the mast of the ship, the bay was shallow enough that the mast of the ship was sticking out of the water. The other theory is that one of the local Native Americans was pillaging the shipwreck. You know, these Native Americans knew that these ships that were coming over from Europe were loaded with supplies and riches from the king. And so it's possible that there was a Native American that was pillaging the shipwreck and got trapped underneath the decking and drowned. And the reason this theory has been proposed is because the location of that set of remains, he was found in the cargo portion of the ship with all of the cargo.
This is extraordinary. As our listeners may know, my students, I've got an incredible team of students here at the University of New Haven. Aaron Griffin was, doing the research interview with you a couple of days ago, and she was fascinated with how you came to do what you do. I mean, just give us a sense of that before we get back to this amazing stories of forensic archaeology. How did you end up doing this? How do you end up becoming one of the world's foremost forensic geneticists?
So it's actually quite interesting. If you had asked me when I was younger, perhaps when I was Aaron's age, if I ever thought I would work on skeletal remains, not just contemporary skeletal remains, but archaeological and historical remains. And bones and skeletal remains were not even on my radar. It was never even something that had struck an interest in me or drawn my attention. What I was doing with my graduate studies was studying to be a forensic DNA analyst. And what I was primarily interested in was challenging samples, degraded samples, more contemporary type casework samples. And our technology...
But you got into that, Angie. You got into specifically looking at detective work and specifically looking at this. Why? What happened to you in high school?
Oh, yes. So Halloween night, 1987, I was in high school, and a very good friend of mine in high school was murdered. I had a group of girlfriends at my house. We had decided that night we were not going to go out and do anything mischievous. We were going to have a scary movie marathon, basically, at my house. And a group of guys, one of the girls that was at my house was the girlfriend of my friend that was murdered. And they did not believe us that we were going to have a movie marathon and not try to play pranks on them or whatever that night. So one of the things, and I don't know how universal this is across the U.S., but one of the things we did in the South, this was in Tennessee, was we would toilet paper people's yards on Halloween as a prank.
Yeah, that sounds pretty typical, pretty culturally, universal. Yes.
So the group of boys, Lance Russell was my friend that was murdered. They were at his house and they just knew we were going to try to ambush his house and toilet paper the yard. So they were hiding in the bushes at his house. And a car pulled into their driveway that just happened to be the same make and model of car of Lance's girlfriend, who was at my house at the time. And it was really a woman and her children that had been trick-or-treating in the neighborhood, and they pulled into the driveway to turn around and go home. And Lance and the group of boys that were there, they thought, oh, we pulled into the driveway to toilet paper his yard and we saw them in the bushes. And so we pulled out and took off. So essentially what happened is the boys chased the car that they thought we were in. And, you know, they were kind of, it was mischievous, but they thought it was us. The windows were tinted, by the way. It was back in the 80s when everybody tinted their windows. And they were driving up close to the car, you know, tailgating the car, just being typical teenage boys, not realizing who it was. And they followed the car back to that woman's house. And of course, she was scared to death. She had her friends, her kids in the car. And her husband ran up to her husband and said these people were terrorizing them and was scared and petrified, and so were the kids. And Lance and the other group of boys that were my friends, they were profusely apologizing and saying it was a mistake, you know, all of that. And this man chased Lance back to his house with a shotgun and proceeded to shoot him at point blank range in the abdomen. And so in the meantime, me and my girlfriends are at my house watching scary movies, and we get a phone call from one of Lance's friends saying that Lance has been shot and he's at the hospital. And I actually hung up on him because I thought he was playing a prank on us.
Yeah, the whole thing just sounds just grotesque. Yeah. As a series of, and you know, there's not one step in that story that you listen to that you don't think of yourself at 17 thinking, yeah, you know, I can do that. You know, I mean, it was a bit of an ass thing to do. Thanks. And so that catapulted you or catalyzed your interest in police work and turning your scientific bent of mind into working on police.
Yeah, I think, you know, this man was tried, and for some reason this struck me as really ironic. He was sentenced to 17 years in prison, and Lance was 17 when he was murdered. And I thought, wow, you know, he got 1 year for every year of Lance's life. And that really troubled me. And that was something I never expected to experience when I was a teenager. I'd never had a friend that had been killed. And I just thought at that point, I got really interested in criminal justice and getting bad people off the streets, so to speak.
In a couple of weeks, we're going to have you back. We're going to be talking about forensic archaeology in Civil War soldiers in Deadwood, South Dakota, and your incredible work in identifying, you know, people dead from hundreds of years ago. But listen, Angie, thank you so much for joining us this today. It's been absolutely eye-opening. I'm still in slight shock from that story of your teenage friend. Just extraordinary. Thank you, Angie.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to that journey back in time, the De La Salle expedition off the coast of Texas with our brilliant forensic analyst, Angie Ambers. It's extraordinary to be able to work with somebody like her and be able to talk about these ideas and the stories. Please, if you liked this episode, we ask that you subscribe on social media, you like, you recommend it to friends. Please comment as well. Any input, any discussion is gratefully, gratefully received. Thank you so much, and we'll join you next week, we hope, with a fresh new episode of Crime Waves Podcast.